Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema for your free 30-day trial of Mubi. Go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Father of mine, tell me where have you been? You know I just closed my eyes, my whole world disappeared. Father of mine, take me back to the day. Yeah, when I was still your golden boy, back before you went away.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your captain, Brian J. Rowan. Joined here by my crewmates, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello. Is Everclear the most 90s band of all time?
I thought that was like Sugar Ray.
Okay, maybe Sugar Ray.
We're the Spin Doctors. I honestly don't know. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Bill, who do you think is the most 90s band of all time?
Or is it Tony?
R.E.M.?
R.E.M. is a good choice, actually.
Yeah.
Damn it, I just had another one and now I can't remember.
Stone Temple Pilots?
Stone Temple Pilots is good.
Honestly, it's got to be Nirvana, right?
But like, yeah, but I feel like they don't encompass the entirety of the 90s. Oh, the Goo Goo Dolls.
Jesus, no.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll leave this to people on Twitter to discuss. Maybe that'll be our next roundtable, because who cares? Let's move on. Today, we will be reviewing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the newest film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That is all we will be doing today. And before we get into that, let me remind everyone you can be found. We can be found. I don't know where the hell you can be found. We can be found on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show. And, of course, you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com or find us on iTunes and give us a comment and a review, because we thrive off of your validation. We are also brought to you, as always, by Mubi, the streaming online cinema where their curators select great films for you to watch. Every day they introduce a new film, and you have 30 days to watch before it disappears into the ether. So that is a constantly rotating roster of 30 films. Oh my god, what is happening? A constantly
happy Monday
roster. Yeah, we're recording on the wrong day, so just like when we record the roundtables on Thursdays, we might be a little loopy. Whew. All right, anyway, stuff that's coming to Mubi: Ars of the Real, and this is part of their continuing collaboration with New York's Film Society of Lincoln Center, and it brings you highlights from this year's Art of the Real Festival, which offers a survey of the most vital and innovative voices in nonfiction and hybrid filmmaking from across the globe. One of the great things about Mubi is that you are able to download their films to your mobile device so that you can watch them on the go. I am planning on doing this in about a month when I have to go to the beach with my family. I say have to go to the beach with my family like I hate my family. I don't.
Yeah,
I hate the beach. The beach is a terrible place for an Irishman. I burn within a day of getting there, and then I have to spend the rest of the week cloistered in a room filled with air conditioning, trying not to move. And Mubi is there.
What's your opinion of sand? Sand is pretty divisive.
It's coarse, and it gets everywhere.
There's this
like
thing.
You're so soft.
Brian, there's this thing I'm not sure you're aware of. It's called sunblock. It generally works.
Oh, Bill, I am with you. However, yet has been made a sunblock that can protect my skin. I adhere to like the golden rule of like every 2 hours you reapply completely, and every time I go in the water I reapply completely.
What SPF rating are we talking about here? Are we talking about 100?
Yeah.
'Cause I got some 100, bro.
Yeah. Man, I don't know what the highest one they make is, but basically my pre-beach thing is to go to the drugstore, find the one with the highest number on it, and use it. And like, I have used Sport, I have used Sweat and Water Resistant, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Or it'll work, but I'll forget the tops of my feet. And then, gentlemen, then we get into the real hell. But anyway, Mubi is fantastic. And for your 30-day trial of MUBI to protect you from the harsh UV rays of the beach sun, go to MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. Okay, so this is we're just off to a really weird start. I would apologize, but if you're listening to us, you should pretty much be used
par
to
for
this
the course.
Now. Yeah, there's nothing there's nothing new happening here. All right, nothing really pressing to talk about that can't wait till the next roundtable. So how about we jump straight into our review of Guardians of the Galaxy, newest film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, written and directed by James Gunn. And it came out this past weekend, and here is the trailer.
Hope you're ready. It'll be here any minute. Is that a rifle?
You don't know what a rifle looks like?
It's just swords were your thing, and guns were mine. But I guess we're both doing guns now. I just didn't know that.
Well, that's intense.
It within.
All right, and that is the trailer for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Let's talk about it. I don't know. Let's say Michael Snydell. Why don't you kick us off giving us your general impressions of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2? Let's also try something fun. Let's not get into any specifics at first. Sure. Let us really try to just give a general overview of our thoughts and opinions.
In no way are you saying that right now because of my insane ramblings.
I mean,
last
there's your
episode,
insane
right?
ramblings, then there's Bill's insane ramblings, and then it gets to me, and I am almost certain that my ramblings become even more insane because I have to follow both of your ramblings. So to all of us, to kick us off, let us just, you're talking to a person on an elevator, and they say, what'd you do this weekend? And you say, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2. And then they say, how was it? And you say...
dot, dot, dot?
Yeah.
Okay, so Guardians, Volume 2. You know, Guardians of the first Guardians of the Galaxy was a film that was kind of the outlier in I don't know if I want to say the original Marvel universe or what phase I want to refer to or anything on those lines, but it's fair to say that even compared to, you know, any of the marquee solo films Guardians of the Galaxy has had the characters that people weren't familiar with, and so it, you know, likewise had this, the original film had this like welcome shagginess and attitude that felt less, dictated by corporate machinations. And so I mention that because, Guardians Volumes 2 is very much another Marvel film, for better or for worse, in the sense that this is not doing anything to really break away from the template of the Marvel movies. And I guess that's fine, because honestly, I think this is a very good one of those. But I do wish I had to stop making these clarifications, because I just don't think that any of these Marvel films are going to be able to reach my personal, some level of greatness until it can dispense with all of the needs that it needs to cater to. So Volume 2 is interesting in the sense that it plays to James Gunn's strengths, in the sense of, you know, the first one had a lot of very muddled choreography, and, you know, it was undeniably stylish, but it also felt like kind of a mess as far as narratively goes, as far as, visual compositions, and you'd be lucky if you could be able to follow some of the fight scenes. And this one, I have to give it credit. I think this is the most visually coherent Marvel film in a very long time. mostly because it doesn't really rely on choreography at all, and kind of focuses on wide angle spectacle and tries to find a way to completely align the rhythm to the previous film's kind of obsession with a mixtape format. But what I really like about this film is that it does ramp up everything. There's no way that you can argue that this isn't more of everything. There's more jokes, there's more things going on, and at times it seems like we're just jumping around the galaxy for the sheer sake of seeing more things. But at the same time, this thing feels a lot more alive to me. And I constantly got the sense that, you know, when I was seeing, you know, these, you know, a space invader drone pilot thing, it was very much a design sensibility that, you know, felt in line with the rest of the movie. Like as much as this thing throws so many things at the wall, it feels more than the kind of like lava lamp, you know, visual pyrokinetics of something like Doctor Strange most recently. And that's because I think that this movie leans very much into the original's emphasis on family and not only that, but the fact that all of these characters have their own histories that they're contending with. And so it's kind of a messy film, and I'm worried to overpraise it because it definitely has some major script problems, but I just had a really good time with this one, and I was continually impressed by the way that it was just kind of slyly serving as a rebuttal to a lot of the criticisms with the first one. We can get into more specific things later, obviously. I am not good at this quick summary. This is a long-ass elevator ride indeed. I recommend this, but if you are not, you know, already into the Marvel Universe, I can't imagine this is going to change your mind.
All right. Bill Graham, elevator sure. ride summary of your feelings on Guardians of the Galaxy.
So I love the first Guardians. It's one of the few Marvel films that I actually own. This one just brings more of that kind of good time feeling. This one is really clever. I found it really emotional as well, surprisingly so. I think Michael Rooker is doing fantastic work as Yondu here. And honestly, like, if you enjoy the craziness and the kookiness of the Fast and the Furious franchise and you don't like this film, there's something wrong with you. Like, there just literally is, because this is the exact same kind of franchise. This is them just going balls out crazy bananas, and this one works so much better than Fast 7 or Fast 8. Fate of the Furious? Yeah, I don't even know what. Like, come on. Like, there's 8 of those fucking things now, and the last one was not very good. And this movie is a sequel to, what was it, 2014's Runaway Hit. It's just a blast. I enjoyed so much of this. There's some little quibbles that I have, but for the most part, if you haven't even been paying attention to the other Marvel films, or even seen the last Guardians film, it doesn't fucking matter. You can stroll right into this, have a blast. It's still one of the only films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that is completely disconnected from the rest of it. So, yeah, I dug it.
Okay, I fucking hated this film. It's a terrible film. I hated every second that I was stuck in the theater with it. It encompasses some of the worst impulses of the Marvel franchise and sequel culture in general. And I detest it. It was the most just boring, grating experience that I've had in a theater since Suicide Squad, probably. But somehow less fun than Suicide Squad, because Suicide Squad was a movie at war with its own creation, and this is just happy popcorn, multicolored nonsense that wouldn't stop even after it had reached a logical ending point at least three times. And it's a movie that lacks any semblance of a plot until perhaps the last, I don't know, because it felt like I was there for 3 hours before the plot finally kicked in, but then I was there like another hour. We could talk about in spoilers when that happens in a plot sense, but like the fact that you can't even really say what the plot of this movie is, because it doesn't happen until like midway through the third act, is just a huge problem. And I was sitting there saying, but what is the story? Like, what are we doing here? Why is this still happening? And then finally the answers come and I just wanted it to be over already. But there was like a whole other movie within the third act of this movie, because it forgot to be a movie for the first 2.5 acts. So this is a terrible movie, and I liked the first Guardians of the Galaxy fine because it was, as we have said, disconnected from the rest of the Marvel Universe. This one ties it in a little more, and I don't like it. And everything that was good about the first film is just louder and longer here, and it's terrible. And I'll just get it out of the way: Baby Groot is a terrible construct, both aesthetically and in character sense, and I wanted him to die or grow up or anything. Fuck this movie.
Hey, Bill, this is going to be a fun podcast, huh?
It's going to be a blast.
I mean,
you know what's funny is, Michael, you and I had some big reservations about Fate of the Furious, and what did Brian do? He came out swinging for that fucking film, and that is a piece of trash film. So it's hilarious that he's going over here and saying this is a piece of trash. So, yeah.
All right. Well,
it's funny because, you know, we both knew as soon as we had to assign this film to be seen, Michael was like, well, fuck. Or sorry, not Michael. Brian was like, well, fuck. And
because
so
I'm just like
yeah,
I'm just hitting
you,
Marvel.
You really don't. Yeah, you don't like these anything that has to do with the MCU. And again, like,
but
I bring it
true.
Up.
Like, I enjoy
the Fate of the Furious is a terrible fucking movie. It is not good by any semblance. It's got one real good, nice action sequence with the baby, and that's about it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say zombie cars.
You went to bat for that film, and that film takes Charlize Theron and puts her in a know-nothing, terrible waste of a role. She's completely wasted on that film. She says, I can't see him 5 times in a row in a 2-minute sequence.
I know,
that is not
a
good, it's not a well-plotted film by any means, and you went to bat for it. And
again,
the other thing about that franchise is you've seen like half of the franchise and you're still like, I love this film.
Yeah,
and I'm just
good.
Like, I was watching through half of this Guardians and it got towards the end and I was like, this is literally the Fast and the Furious franchise. Like, this
no,
is
it's not,
like,
though,
it,
because
it is. It's got all of these various characters that have all of these special quirks and all of these special things. Mm-hmm. And they're always they're sort of bad guys. Right. But they're kind of good. Right.
And they always talk about being family.
Yes, they talk about being a family right now. And they definitely steal a lot of things, right? There's always some kind of big heist at the middle of it. Like this is and none of them can die. Literally none of them can die. And in this film, literally one character finds out he literally cannot die, right?
But like what I would say to that is that Fate of the Furious had a clearly defined plot that I was able to follow.
Who gives a fuck about that?
Obviously,
like,
I do.
Like, it was a terrible plot, though.
Yeah, it's not a perfect plot, but it's a plot. Like,
these have very similar plots, honestly.
Yeah,
if you guys want to actually like compare these apples and oranges, I think that the idea that this movie doesn't have a plot till the third act is missing the entire point. I would agree that there is not a single narrative thread in the same way as Guardians, but Guardians 2 makes it very clear what it's about very early on. Sure. And decides to see it through from the beginning to the end. Yeah. I will agree that there is like some, you know, narrative detritus with things like the Sorvain and, you know, or the Sovereign, excuse me.
The Sorvain.
Jesus.
Okay, this is how this movie progresses. Sovereign, Frank, crash land on a planet. Split up the group, mutiny.
Let him finish.
I am not going to disagree that I think this film has some narrative detritus in things like the Sovereign, in things that do feel like they don't always connect in terms of the rhythms. But I completely disagree that this movie doesn't have a plot or a narrative. It makes its theme very clear. And I'm not going to disagree again that it is blunt, but it is about a single thing throughout the entire film. So I think to say that a plot emerges in the third act, I would say the nature of tension and conflict related to that thing emerges in the third act. But the whole movie is kind of refreshingly very different from a lot of superhero movies in the sense that it's not save the world in the sense of it's clear from the beginning what the stakes are. The stakes are so small, wonderfully small at the beginning here as we – shit. Am I veering into spoilers here?
Yeah, I think so because that's fine. What this movie is. Hmm. And Bill, I would like to butt up against one thing you said. You said I don't like anything attached to the MCU, which is a damnable lie. I have liked every Captain America film. I liked Ant-Man.
Brian, you also said you didn't want to see Doctor Strange because it looked like a piece of shit to you.
Yeah, it did.
What? But
But that's again. I've just pointed out at least four movies, and I enjoyed the first Iron Man. So that's five of, I don't know. There are probably, how many movies are there in the MCU by now?
Ooh, who the fuck?
12.
I was about to say 16, but I mean, I'm not against these things on principle. Like, I don't mind that they're a mill of the same kind of movie told with different ticks here and there. I like that they've started to get a little more formally daring. I gave Ant-Man credit for being a heist film. I gave The Winter Soldier credit for being like a paranoid 70s thriller. I mean, I'm willing to give these films a shot. And I liked, as far as I remember, Guardians of the Galaxy. But I didn't like this film.
Yeah.
I just don't understand.
Okay. No. You're fine. Like you know who you're dealing with. I have shitty memories. So
that's true.
I'm sorry to drag your name through the Marvel mud. My bad.
Marvel pays me a lot to like their films more than the DC films, and I just don't want to lose the payroll.
I don't think we should play the game of whether this is like a fate of the fear. I see where you're specifically going with that, Bill, but I don't think that's very productive. I think we can have a productive conversation about in a way that like a Brian, like that opening volley doesn't exactly open itself up to conversation.
No, I know.
Like you're teeing up a little bit.
I am willing. I hated this movie, but I am willing to get into specifics about the parts that I didn't hate so much. And I think there are parts in this movie that work, but they're so fleeting amongst the bulk of everything else that I hated that, unlike some films where I could say, you know, okay, Bill, like you said, you know, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, awful. But that fight scene apparently was good enough that you said it was almost worth recommending just on that. But like, there's none of that in this. There's no moment so large that it's worth wading through everything else, and most of it depends on everything else. And so I just can't do it. And you know, yes, the Fast and Furious franchise for the last four movies has been a series of crazy nonsensical things happening, but oftentimes I am invested in those characters, and I've been with them so long that I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt or something. I don't know what the difference is per se. I really couldn't defend why I like one and not the other, but it's sort of like I like tuna, but I hate salmon. Yes, they're both fish. They are both basically the same color and are often prepared in the same way, but there is some intangible, immutable thing that I think I enjoy. Maybe it's in the preparation.
Sure.
Maybe it's in the love of the chefs. But I'm with Michael. We shouldn't bring up Fate of the Furious. We should try to judge this film on its own merits.
Well,
and
okay.
I couldn't do it.
Let's get one thing through, because I definitely have to bring this up. How are you the only person on planet Earth not to like Baby Groot?
That's not true.
How is
that
possible? Charles Bermesco just did a damning piece on Esquire today. I'm bringing him up as a contrarian. But there are quite a few people who are talking about their hatred of Baby Groot, which I honestly don't have a strong enough opinion to think he's terrible or to think he's great.
Do you like Gizmo from Gremlins?
No, not really.
Oh, what?
I like the aliens from Batteries Not Included. I don't know why I'm bringing that up.
What? I don't even know what that is.
All right, never mind then.
What
about the Ewoks in Star Wars?
No, I'm not a fan of the Ewoks.
Ewoks suck. That's not a good comparison.
If I could, gentlemen, I have a couple of issues with Baby Groot. One of them is that we keep calling him Baby Groot. Like,
that's his literal name.
But is it his name? Because he doesn't say, "I am Baby Groot." He says, "I am Groot." So he's still Groot, and it seems a little fucked up to keep calling him Baby Groot, especially because, like, that's what he's credited as. It's just, it's too cute. Like, there's a knowingness to this movie that moves from meta into just being, what's that word? Oh, patronizing. That wasn't a bit. I literally couldn't remember that word. So I didn't like that. I also didn't like that, like, his
Brian.
We are a bitless
podcast.
Our
show is entirely bits. Are you kidding?
Oh my God. His strength and his skill set wavers from scene to scene in a way that I find very dramatically unsatisfying.
Referring specifically towards the end, not being specific, but there are times where he seems far more capable than others?
There's times where, like, mentally and physically, yes. Like,
he is a plot device that just have laughs. Like, his basic plot function is to basically be goofy and cute and just, like, generally slow down the pace of the film and everything like that.
It's
like the sequence with Yondu and stuff like that.
Oh,
like,
God.
All of that.
Yeah, sometimes he can't understand simple instructions. Yeah. And sometimes he's endlessly capable and also a physical force to be reckoned with. But then in other occasions, a bunch of drunk sailors can pour beer on him and get a tiny uniform on him. I have a problem with that. Because Groot in the first movie was, I think, very well defined. And I don't, you know, the fact that he can still make giant vines, but he's like the size of a remote control is, it's easier to take that when he's like a hulking 7 foot tall thing. But like, I guess this is just a question in general, but like, why can't he just grow himself bigger?
I don't know. I don't know the dynamics of him, and that mystery kind of it irks at me too. Like these are small quibbles that you've made for yourself, at least, into big quibbles, and I've made into small Groot size or baby Groot size quibbles.
Teenager Groot sized quibbles.
Baby Groot sized problems. Oh my God.
And then I just had
no
a problem
bits.
With like,
no bits.
Yeah, we're no bits. We're a bitless podcast. Save the bits for the drills and data storage.
Okay. Well, let's use this to like. All right. So. You are not alone in finding this film very abrasive, Brian. I have definitely seen people. It's been very interesting to see some people who think this is better than it seems almost like almost 60-40, 50-50 of people who think this is both better and worse than the original.
Well, yeah, because I can see why certain people would think that, because it is more of what you loved the first time.
Absolutely,
but I think in a bad way.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that, because this is kind of playing to the strengths of what it is, and sure. You know, I saw someone mention earlier that Drax was kind of the secret weapon of Guardians of the Galaxy 1, and
for
this
sure.
film he is front and center to the point where if you. Like, it can almost get a little grating how much he laughs and how much he's just, like, crazy in this film. But, like, honestly, like, Dave Bautista's performance of Drax,
sure.
I just found him so charming and so fun to be around. Because
it's not the lines. It's his like, delivery, like, every time.
It's his delivery, but it's also like it also is kind of the lines, because I find this film cleverly written to the point where you just don't know whether he's joking or whether he's like being serious. And that fine line is a lot of fun, because he's got a poker face for ages and you're just like, I don't. And then when he laughs, you're like, OK, now it's funny. You know, it's almost. It's one of those weird performances where you're just – is he autistic? Like, this guy is crazy.
I had an issue because – I mean, there was one trailer that felt like it was just made up of a bunch of scenes. And so it's like they're talking to an empath and she happens to like out Peter Quill's love of Gamora. And Drax,
sure.
like, reacts in a way that, honestly, and this is so, I hate that I'm saying this right now, but it feels out of character for him as we knew him in the first film. And maybe, like, time has changed him, and he's, like,
yeah, I think
more.
So.
But, like, if that's true, then I don't like his growth. I prefer an understated reactionary force.
Well, in the first film, he is pretty freshly off of his family's murder, isn't he? I'm pretty sure. So he's
the genocide of his people, wasn't it?
Yeah. So he's he's definitely like in a darker place than he is now. Like you mentioned, Brian, this film is very much about family, and that's the kind of sense I get. And on that point, I love what they do with Rocket and how they kind of fold that into things. Because he is an a-hole, and throughout the first film, he specifically is kind of grating against a lot of people, and this film kind of continues that to a point where it kind of rides it out to a nice logical conclusion that I really kind of appreciated.
I think it's fair to say that they smooth out, especially the alien characters, like someone like Gamora or Drax, as you're saying, like they are definitely smoothed out to be more recognizably human.
Yeah.
And I personally like that, because I then found I wouldn't go so as far to say moving, but I did find the way that this film kind of continually reminds you of the histories that these characters have had with each other as well as on their own. I feel like this movie is far more interested in recognizing that and being able to take a breather and say, hey, these characters aren't just reactions. Like it's interesting that you call Drax an understated reactionary force, Brian, because I often felt that the first film didn't ever take, you know, the wisecracking, for instance, it often felt like that was just supposed to break up the action. And in this one especially, it felt far more character-based to me. You mean not only and yes, maybe that did become a little bit too much, that the fact that they are constantly joking with each other. And even someone like Rocket, his arc is a little too neat for my liking, in terms of how much he needs to be an asshole. And, you know, I actually, a pan of this review by Simon Abrams, he said it's – one word he used was needy. He said that this is a very needy sequel.
Yeah.
And I actually really like that characterization, because I think it's one thing I really like about the film is that it does kind of require you to meet it halfway, while also very much being that, you know, Marvel spectacle. It is a film that does require you to recognize these people as humans and spend time with them.
But they're not
humans. As just like Brian.
Like, does that matter though? Like,
human-like.
Fine. Human-light. Let's whatever word you want to use. Fine. Human, I'm using specifically as just a reference point of being able to empathize with these characters more and understanding things through a context of, you know, psychological reactions and human relationships. But again, I recognize they aren't human, but right.
The reason I said that they're not human is because in the first film, I felt like Drax's responses were things that I would not have thought of on my own, and thus he felt genuinely alien. Like when they don't have idioms or analogies, or they only speak literally. And Peter Quill says something like, is going to go over his head. And he's like, nothing could go over my head. I'm too fast. I would catch it. Like, that was a laugh line that we don't usually get in these movies, because his delivery was so perfect and that setup was great. And I would not have seen.
Yeah. I love that, because he even delivers it and he like kind of whispers it like it's under his breath. He's just like, nothing would get over my head. I would catch it.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not saying it to Quill necessarily. He's just like,
sure.
No.
Yeah. He's like, what is this idiot human talking about? But in this film, you know, it's like, oh, you have strong romantic and sexual feelings for Gamora. And he's like, bah, ha, 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 she revealed your dark secret. And
Hold on. You went Yoda voice on that. So I don't know what was going on there.
I was under my breath. Is that I don't know why I did that in a Muppet voice. But also that leads
your
me
own
to another
moment.
Another issue is like, is his feelings for Gamora a dark secret? Like, I feel like he's been fairly open about them since the first
movie. I think it's just embarrassing because you can see Quill's reaction to it is like, no, because again, like, we can't get into that. Let me try and steer away from this.
Gamora has like a character background that is related to why she would specifically rebuff Quill. Like, if you, I would agree that I don't think the movie does a great job explaining it, but like, I think that that script is very much trying to say that she has only had abusive relationships with the men in her life, like her father, Thanos, and therefore that's why.
And then Ronan.
And Ronan.
I was just about to say, who the fuck is Ronan? And then I remembered that that's the name of the guy from the last movie. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 had perhaps one of the worst Marvel villains of all time.
Agreed. Yeah, Ronan the Destroyer is not a very good character.
Except he might be.
They
tied.
Wasted Lee Pace.
they did waste Lee Pace. And he may be tied with whoever the guy in Thor the Dark
Christopher
World.
Because the Dark Elf.
Yeah. So those are two great actors who got buried under very similar makeup jobs and had very similar like desires, and so I constantly mix them up.
But Apocalypse is the exact same. They wasted Oscar Isaac.
His name was Apocalypse? Oh jeez.
You didn't know his name was Apocalypse?
Oh wait, that's the X-Men one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I haven't seen that one. I can't.
Just gave Michael a heart attack.
Poor Michael, having to be reminded of that. Yeah, I mean that's a problem. And I think that one of the things that I will say that this movie does well is there are a few of those character human-based moments, Michael, that you were talking about. There's a moment between Drax and Mantis that I think is very affecting, wherein her empathetic abilities allow us to see a side of Drax that we wouldn't otherwise see.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there was another one I wanted to bring up.
What about the Yondu stuff?
No.
No, that didn't work for you?
No. I think that one of the things this movie did really well was humanizing Nebula, who is, if you know, I have trouble tracking the names of some of the second tier characters in the movie. That's played by Karen Gillan. She's the blue one. And
I thought she was awful.
Blue and purple and okay. Yeah, whatever.
Michael, I will say this. She, for like most of this movie, is awful. I couldn't stand her delivery. I thought that her character motivations were terrible. She came off as just super petulant and annoying. And then we learn a story about her, and she confronts Gamora with the fallout of that story. But the problem is that the result of that entire interaction and arc is that now I just want to see Gamora die. And that can't be what the movie was moving towards, but like I feel like Gamora needs a reckoning of the highest order, because, and we could talk about it in spoilers, when you break down that story, it is horrifying.
Yeah, sure.
Speaking of spoilers, should we wrap up our general thoughts and move into the plot? You know, such as it is, or you know, there's a lot of it when it gets to it.
Let's touch on a couple of things, because I think there's definitely some things that we have to kind of touch on before we jump right into spoilers.
Sure.
First off, the opening sequence with Kurt Russell. How did y'all feel that worked?
Oh, that hair. Russell hair.
I feel bad saying this, but I don't know why they chose the actress they chose I guess I can't really specify this. I thought that actress, I thought she was kind of weak, and that moment didn't have the impact that I needed. But then, you know, I have more overall positive feelings about that character, though.
Her accent choice was bizarre.
Strange, yeah.
Because they're singing, Brandy.
Brandy.
Yeah.
By Looking Glass, I believe. And she's singing it with like this weird southern twang. And I was like, is she making fun of this song? And then she was speaking normally, and she still had this weird southern twang. But aren't they in like Wisconsin?
Well, if there's a Dairy Queen, they're in the South. There's no doubt about that.
Is Missouri the South? I don't want to I think it's border. Okay.
I think it's border.
All right. That's fair. Yeah, I thought that scene in general was like, it didn't feel necessary, in all honesty. Like once we got to the end of the movie, like,
sure, it's kinda that was weird. Needed. My main question more was because of the Grand Moff Tarkin thing, and like, how did we feel about the look of that character?
I finally caught up on that this weekend.
I think digitally de-aging someone is usually a better end result than creating a dead man whole cloth.
Sure, sure.
And so,
did he look better or worse than Bridges?
He looked worse, actually. I thought that they did a pretty poor job on him, but then, you know, he is an alien, so who knows? And also, his hair was so distracting that I had trouble looking at his face.
Yeah.
But I think that's just a function of 80s hair and not, like, computer imagery.
One thing that I haven't seen a whole lot of people kind of point out in this is his face at one point actually interacts with another person's face while it's de-aged. So that was kind of creepy because I was like, wait, what's going on here? Generally, generally we see a lot of monologues with these kind of DH characters. I still think Michael Douglas in Ant-Man is still the kind of premier, the best one so far. I'm not even sure why. It just looked flawless. It was short enough to where it didn't overstay its welcome. Versus Tarkin, like, was just incredibly distracting.
Tarkin looked like Anton Ego from Ratatouille. But what I'll say is, like, with the Michael Douglas thing, a lot of his earlier roles in that age bracket that they were trying to go for were him standing in a room of speechifying. So they had a lot to work with. I think the recreation they did of Robert Downey Jr. for Winter Soldier?
Civil War.
Okay, yeah. For Civil War was fine, and they kind of I think they may have like dressed it down just because it was literally a computer recreation in the story.
The biggest thing with that Robert Downey Jr. thing for me, and I know we can kind of move on out of this quickly, but was his body type and the size of his head in relation to his body type, and that just kind of threw me off because I was like, that's definitely not Robert Downey Jr.'s body.
But I feel like he had that when he was younger. I think he looked like that. Like,
yeah, that doesn't work for me in this case. So yeah.
Other thoughts? Baby Groot looked bad. Like Final Fantasy VII.
I think the CG actually looks really good throughout this entire movie.
All right. I mean, that's your prerogative.
Real quick. Did you want to see this in 3D?
No.
No.
Okay. Because I've heard the 3D actually, from one friend in particular, he is ranting and raving about the 3D. And I can see, especially towards the end, especially when we start getting onto a certain planet and then a certain sequence towards the end, I can see that being pretty spectacular in 3D. But beyond that, I don't know. This film... I don't know. I watched the first film in 3D, and I thought the first 5 minutes of it were fantastic, and then it did nothing with the 3D from that point on.
You mean like the first 5 minutes, like on Earth?
No, the first 5 minutes, because he's definitely. I'm pretty sure the film starts with him on that planet where he's getting
When does it flash back to him and his mind?
Shortly after. After that. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, I guess I'm alone on the Baby Groot thing. I was going to say that, like, the problem was that he's small, so every time you see him, he's in close-up, and maybe they, like, couldn't... You know, a 7-foot-tall guy, you can look at from 20 feet away and still get most of his features, but, like, when he's 3 inches tall, you've got to be up in his eyes, and I think that the closeness, they didn't do enough detail to sell him. But, I mean, if I'm alone in that opinion, Rocket looked great.
Rocket looked fantastic. Wow. Yeah. That is incredible. It's really incredible good piece of work.
Yeah. Motion capture there. Yeah.
Yeah. And then but like in general, like I said, like there's just they add too much that was good from the first film. I mean, Yondu had in the first film that cool little arrow thing that he did. And
around it was a little bit too much. I agree.
Yeah. Even which is weird because the scene with the music on the ship is very well done, but like by that point he's used it so much that it's kind of you're deadened to it.
Yeah.
And
it's one of those
sequence where he uses it, isn't it?
What I'm
in this film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's two sequences where three sequences where he uses it.
Yeah, but I mean the I think what Brian's kind of getting at is it's kind of giving this character this kind of unbeatable weapon where you're just like, wow.
Okay. Sure.
Like there were points when I was like, wow, he is more powerful than a god. But also
like, it's kind of ridiculous.
That
it's
scene kind of with that song, the Come a Little Bit Closer. Mm-hmm. You know, that scene goes on for like th- 3 to 5 minutes before they get to like the climax of that scene. And I think if you had just held off on him using that until the climax, that the climax would have felt a lot higher than it did. But by that point, I was kind of getting telepathic arrow whistling fatigue.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he has a sidekick or two during that sequence that don't seem to do a lot until the very end. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, that should have been what they were doing until he had to really break out his power and really start to use it.
Yeah, like if instead of Groot bringing him the fin, they had to go and fight their way to the fin, and then he puts it on, and then you see all of that stuff, I think that would have been interesting.
Yeah.
But, all right, so we've been talking for 50 minutes. Let's get into some plot and spoilers and junk and see if we can work out some more of this. So I hated it. I wouldn't suggest that you go see it. Mike and Bill both enjoyed it. You know, I'm almost certain that I'm going to have a minority opinion on this. And I honestly was shocked how much I hated this film. But once I began to hate it, it was like I had crossed an event horizon and my dislike of this film became a black hole that sucked me in.
Again, though, if you don't like Marvel movies, I can't imagine this is going to change your mind. I did quite enjoy this, but I'm just going to say that. And Bill, I see what you're saying, how it is disconnected far more than some of the other Marvel films and feels far less intimidating. But I still think there is very much a template and formula that this is going through that is either to your liking or not.
Well, I mean, specifically when I'm saying you don't have to see the other Marvel films to enjoy this one, what I am not saying is if you hate the Marvel films and then you see this one, that's not going to change your opinion. No.
Which is weird. Like, fair, fair. The first Guardians of the Galaxy, I told friends who were like, man, I hate the Marvel films. Like, there's too much to track. And I was like, dude, you don't have to know shit for this movie.
Sure.
It's just a fun, irreverent space opera. You know, I had friends and I'd like favorably compared it to things like Star Wars and Firefly.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like a good
Suicide Squad.
Yeah, it was like the sugary chocolate cereal version of something better. And I was like, but you know, you dig in with a spoon, you drink the milk, it's great. And they were like, great, that sounds wonderful. This was like just there's a food metaphor somewhere.
Let me grab it from you. It is like if you like Lucky Charms, but specifically you like, you know, the marshmallow aspect of it. But if someone gave you nothing but marshmallows, you'd be like, no, this sucks.
Okay, this is crazy, but wasn't there a Just Marshmallows Lucky Charms?
Yes, there was.
They made that, right? Yeah. No, and yeah. Here's
I'm sure it was terrible. I can't imagine you just eating marshmallows.
I agree with what you said, but also imagine that you get the same amount that you would usually get in a cereal bowl, but they're all the size of apples. Which just is like a seemingly good thing that you find out is bad, but on a scale that you were not prepared to deal with. So let's Sorry, Mike.
I really need to up my food metaphor game, I guess.
You do. I have already compared this movie to fish, and now to sugary cereal. And let's go into the plot. So this is spoilers for Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2.
So it's like when they put salmon in your Lucky Charms, is what you're saying?
Oh my god, that sounds just the worst possible thing that anyone could ever do.
I would love
someone who skipped right to the spoilers and that's the first thing they hear and they're just like, well, I don't even know what's going on anymore. So here's the plot of the movie that we couldn't talk about.
Do you want to give this? Because I thought you specifically said that this film doesn't have a plot.
Can we have Bill do this one, please? Brian, like if you really don't think there's a plot here, I would rather have Bill.
But I said that there is a plot. It just comes in really late.
That's not true, though. That's really not true.
The film starts and ends,
but that's not true.
With the search for Peter Quill's father and trying to figure out.
Start with the search for Peter Quill's father. The film starts with them defending a place, and then rocket heisting stuff from it, and then them being shot down, and then a group of the Reavers? Ravagers?
Ravagers. But Reavers, you are also Firefly. Failing to recognize that a mysterious ship saves the Guardians.
Yes.
Like, it is from the beginning, like, foreshadowed what this actually is going to be about. Like, I see what you're saying there, and it's indirect, but it is absolutely about that from the beginning.
But okay, so yes, it does introduce this man who is played by Kurt Russell, whose name is Ego, which is a thing.
He's a celestial, which is going to tie into
that's
the bigger...
A spoiler, right?
We're in spoilers.
We are in spoilers, but I just wanted to... Because we didn't bring up anything related to him in the non-spoiler
Definitely.
Section.
No. Yeah, no.
Okay. But so he saves them. They crash. Bounty hunters are got to find them and kill them. Meanwhile, the Sovereigns are still after them. So it really does seem like it's going to be a chase movie. But then, like, everything stops. They go to Ego's planet, which is literally what Ego is. Ego is a planet. And meanwhile, Groot and... Why do I keep wanting to call him Rapscallion?
Rocket.
The raccoon.
What?
Who should totally be called Rapscallion. He and Baby Groot are taken in by the Ravagers. And there's a mutiny.
False.
So Yondu... No. What I mean is captured.
Okay.
Right. They're not... It's not friendly. They are against their will, along with Nebula, because Nebula was given to them by the Sovereign. And
yes.
So Nebula, Groot, and Rocket are taken captive, but Nebula's sort of on the side of the crew because the crew is mutinying against Yondu. So Yondu is put into the holding pen with Rocket, and Groot is given a uniform and made a mascot. And then he helps them escape. But not before the Ravagers tell the Sovereign where the other people are. So they go and find them. And at this point, Nebula already got off and found Ego and is fighting Gamora because Gamora had a fight with Peter Quill because she won't reciprocate his feelings. At the same time, Drax is becoming friends with Mantis, who tells him what's up with Ego. And then it turns out that Ego, who is a celestial, we have found out, Peter is not his only son. He has impregnated a member of seemingly every alien race, hoping to create another celestial so that he could then share power with that celestial so that they can make these plants that he's planted on every place he's ever been expand and grow and cover those places in blue goo. And he's
and
killed
plot,
a lot of them.
The plot thread there is, I'm trying to remember specifically, it is so that he can basically populate the universe.
Yeah.
He wants to be the whole universe.
Okay.
Like he realizes that he has the ability to take over things. So it's literally just the possible end result that he can become the universe. He just wants to fuck every planet, essentially.
And what would he? What does he gain from that?
Because
I
then
don't know.
He will become. He's just a monomaniacal narcissist. Like that's
like there's a light side of this, and then there's a dark side of this. The light side, hold on.
I'm interested to hear this. Yes.
The lighter side of this is because he mentions specifically that he cannot stay away from his planet for very long without having to recharge and go back to his planet. So he has to hop back and forth. The lighter side of this is that through this process, he doesn't necessarily kill everybody, right?
Are you sure about that?
No, hold on. that it, I'm saying that that is a plot thread that they could have gone down, where basically what he's doing is he's planting himself inside of each planet so he can stay wherever the hell he wants forever and it won't matter.
So that's,
that is the lighter plot thread potential.
Right. And that is a hypothetical possibility in your mind, but that is 100% not what the movie is doing.
Okay.
That is left to dangle for quite a while, though. I have to give this movie some credit that, like, they actually let you sit with that possibility for a bit for character development, as well as wondering what, you know, the exact motivation is.
Yeah. And so where were we? Everyone's on the planet now. They all decide they have to kill Ego because again, he's got this plan. Because his Kurt Russell avatar does have to come back to the planet to recharge. And so when those flowers grow, presumably once they've covered the entire surface of the planet, his light would then be able to flourish within that planet.
I don't know if that's necessarily like true. I think Michael's right. He just wants to take over the entire universe just because. Like, why not? He makes it very, very obvious that he don't give no shits about any of these people because they're mortal. Exactly. Yeah. He's like, that stuff is for the birds, emotions, friendships.
I get that, but I don't get it.
It's a struggle. That stuff.
Wanted to kill people as retribution for what he perceived as a genocide.
Sure.
Like,
sure,
it's a dumb reason, but it's a trackable reason. But
yeah,
Ego is this, like, I'm this, cool. This is, life is disappointing. I'm gonna take it out.
This kind of mythos stuff comes up a lot with like vampires and stuff like that because of their specific immortality, and they're like, I just float through the world and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like,
that was, in fact, the plot of Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yeah, it's not the most fun plot thread to kind of follow through. It kind of sucks. Yeah, it's kind of lonely.
It's a lot more amorphous than the rest of the movie, and I think it suffers for that reason. But, like, at the same time, I also think, like, you know, going back to what we were talking about with Doctor Strange, Bill, in the sense of how we were talking about how we were wondering how Marvel was going to get as metaphysical as the comics. And it's crazy that now we've had multiple movies that, like, have these characters and it doesn't feel that strange.
Yeah, they've done a really good job. I mean, and that was like early seeding with like Thor and the Rainbow Bridge and how they sold that. And sure, like people were like, you know, you didn't see a bunch of people online being like, Rainbow Bridge, what the hell is that thing? Like, that doesn't make any sense. No, it just worked in the film. And like, it's literally called a Rainbow Bridge. And you're just like, ugh. The Bifrost.
What I was going to say is, you know, Iron Man came out and it was sort of like riding the coattails of Batman Begins. It came out the same year as Dark Knight, actually. So it was like, it was realistic.
Did it really? Oh, yeah. 2009, right?
Yeah. So they kind of did themselves a disservice because they started off realistic and then they had to course correct. Where I think if they had come out of the gate being weird, they wouldn't have had to do that. That being said, they've done a fine enough job of selling this weirdness. I think this is a thing that is slightly raised by this movie. I think it's to their detriment that they still haven't really made Thanos a character. Like, we hear some stuff about him. He apparently is a real shit dad. Like, what he did to Nebula. Because Nebula and Gamora are his daughters, right? Like, biologically? Or did he, like, steal them from people?
I think
Gamora stole them, isn't it? Isn't she?
Yeah. I think Gamora is stolen, and Nebula is his literal daughter that he started to morph and change. I don't know. His lineage is what? The Gamora stuff.
Yeah. Nebula is like, you know, my dad Thanos used to make me fight Gamora, and every time I would lose, he would replace a piece of me with, like, a machine, because he wanted me to be her equal. And she kept beating me, and he kept ripping parts off of me. And I was just like, holy shit, why didn't Gamora ever let her win? Like, what? Or, like, fight to a standstill, at least, like, if that's your thing. So, like, Gamora's weird pride made her have her sister be tortured and, like, ripped to pieces and replaced with machines?
I don't know if that's what I took away from it.
That's what Nebula says when she, like, goes down to the planet. She's like, all I wanted was a sister, and you just had to keep beating me.
Yeah, but we don't know what the repercussions are if Gamora loses either, do we?
No, we don't. Nebula would only know what was going to happen to her. But I mean, like, what is he going to do? Keep swapping out pieces of them constantly forever? Like, until he just has two robot daughters? This is what I'm talking about. I don't know shit about Thanos. So I don't know if he was like, once they were both equal, he was going to say, like, congratulations, you're my warriors, let's go fuck shit up. Or if, you know, it was going to be whoever loses gets a new bionic eye. But like
Gamora
when she said that and then she went to talk to Gamora, I was like, holy shit, like, what a horrible person.
Yeah. Gamora is the stepdaughter of Thanos. Let me see what Nebula. Adopted okay. daughter.
Now, is that like adopted with air quotes? Like, did he steal her from a family he destroyed? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty sure. Okay. And what does it say? It does not say much about Nebula.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you know, it's an interesting
I strongly
thing.
Disliked everything with this, so that's why I have nothing to say about this.
I mean, I remember liking Karen Gillan in the first film. In this film, I found her, like, insufferable until she told that story. Wow. And I was like, okay, well, I kind of get it, but you're still coming off more petulant and, like, whiny than full of righteous fury.
I still haven't liked her in anything other than Doctor Who, and I feel bad about it.
Well, you know, Jumanji's coming out, so maybe
that's true. Yeah. Oh man.
So she's the adopted daughter of Thanos as well.
Okay.
So
again,
I think Thanos is just been gathering up people.
So how many kids does he have?
A
lot, probably. Just like Ego. Mm-hmm. Here's the question. Are we just willing to accept that they stumbled upon the cave where he happened to hide all of his children's bones? Like, he has an entire planet, and he, like, didn't scatter them in different places. He, like, consistently took them to the same pile of bones.
I feel like
my issue is he doesn't realize that other people have landed on his planet.
He is
literally a planet.
I was expecting that when Gamora cut that plant, that he was gonna, like, you know, say something, and then they were gonna realize, like,
yeah,
if we hurt the planet, we hurt him. But yeah,
I also interpreted that he wouldn't even, like, he believed that he was so impenetrable and that his plan was so perfect that he wouldn't even bother hiding it. Like, I feel like there is definitely a thread within the movie that, like, he thinks his plan is bulletproof and, like, that planet, like, there's something off about it from the minute they get there. So, like, I don't know. I see where you're coming from, like, in logistics point of view. But I kind of like thinking that it was a purposeful script writing thing and not just a, you know, a semi-sized hole.
Now, also, would you tell your son who you're trying to get to kill all of his friends that you murdered his mom? With a brain tumor?
I mean, I think he believed in that moment he was delusional enough to believe that if he imparted the level or the magnitude of power that Quill had, that he would ignore it.
Interesting.
I think that's a character thing.
I can see that, but I feel like we didn't, like, there wasn't enough time spent there to, like, really sell that. Because, like, this movie feels like it takes place over the course of, like, 2 days. It's hard to tell when they're in space so often, because there's no day-night cycle.
Yeah, that's true. because literally, like, they're flying through and stars are all around them, so it can be day, it could be night. But a lot of this film seems to take place at night, except for the stuff on Ego.
Yeah, if you told me that this movie happened in real time, I would believe you.
Yeah, I guess
like
that.
That's just where we are. I mean, I don't know. I like when you get to like them having to fight a living planet, and like I thought that his whole like illustration of being a giant brain was a metaphor, and then to find out that he really was a giant brain, and he's a living planet, but like, he doesn't compose himself as a planet that we understand it. So, like, I thought they were going to have to, like, basically reenact the core. But instead, they just, like, drill down a little bit, and suddenly they're in a big open place with many platforms that are good for fighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just feel like that's a lack of imagination, you know?
I mean, I kind of like how that last battle does almost feel like a commentary, like an actual commentary about the problems of how superheroes, you know, whether they are mortal or not. Like, this movie at least is upfront about the fact that they are immortal and therefore can just kind of dispense with the bullshit about them getting hurt and just kind of make, you know, an emotionally punchy climax.
But it's just Peter who's immortal. But, like, everyone else takes similar amounts of damage.
I don't necessarily agree with that. But there is, like, very much, like, I mean, there's a very, like, Matrix Revolutions-esque. We don't like Revolutions?
No.
All right.
In fact, you can't bring up the Matrix sequels around me and Jordan, our benevolent Lord and Master, because I still yell at him every time
about
they
Nick Newman?
Come up. I don't really talk to Nick Newman enough. And plus, Jordan was the guy who had the final say. The fact that the Matrix sequels got on our top sci-fi of the last, or the new millennium, but Interstellar did not, is still one of the greatest injustices perpetrated
that
by any
Nick,
human
though,
being
wasn't
ever.
It?
Nick wanted to do it. Jordan agreed. And because Jordan is the one with the most power in that situation, I still give him shit about it. As well I should. Anyway, I had a question. I thought it was super cool that Peter Quill ended up being like a celestial immortal guy who had power. And at the end, he has this level of... He becomes like a true like battle god type of guy. And I think that it would have been interesting for him to have had this battle and done all this stuff, and then have to, like, maybe in the next film, learn not to be a dick about it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like your best friend who suddenly comes into a lot of money, and it just amplifies all of his worst characteristics. Was it a problem to anyone? Like, they gave it to him and then took it away?
Here's my theory. They haven't taken it away. I don't follow the logic that because the Celestial birthed him, that when that Celestial – I don't think this is a werewolf scenario. Or is that right? No, the werewolf?
Well,
no.
Well, the problem is –
vampire? Is it a vampire?
When you kill – I think it – you know what? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember.
But no, it's not.
I think it's vampire.
I think it might be.
Yeah.
But it's not because his dad died. It's because the planet's not there. And his dad was very clear. The light is in the planet. You have to be here on this planet to recharge the light within you. So if the planet's gone, regardless of dad, like Peter would have to make his own light recharging planet.
Why can't he?
I don't know, but the movie doesn't.
So that's what I'm saying is, I think I think as we move along in this Marvel Cinematic Universe, when we're starting to head towards Thanos and stuff like that, I think we're going to have this because he's a Celestial. He's right. Regardless of whether he killed his father or not, he is still ultimately part Celestial. Like that's just going to be in his DNA, period, forever. I don't know.
He's only part Celestial.
Yes, so he's a half breed. We'll see.
First of all, unnecessary. Hey. So
he's a mudblood.
I think one of the problems I have with this movie is that like things like that,
no bits,
just come up willy nilly and then seem to be discarded. I mean, like we have this question of could Peter go out and make his own world? Like, could he? Because at the end, they have to give him a spacesuit because he's not immortal anymore. So he can't surf on the back of a spaceship like his dear old dad could. Now, I guess so we don't know. It's something they could bring up in a next film, or they could never talk about it again. But, like, I feel someone should say, like, so you were a god for, like, a day, and now you're not. Are you dealing with any regrets?
Remember what Ego said specifically, though. He said that Peter Quill, one of the reasons that he was tipped off that Peter Quill was potentially his son was because Peter Quill held a cosmic cube.
Yeah, the Infinity Stone. But he said But again, he seemed to intimate that the only reason he wasn't killed was because the planet existed somewhere.
I don't like that at all. I don't like that at all because how does that work? Because
look, Bill, I don't know.
He never visited that planet, so he never had that power. No, I don't think that's the. I don't think. Oh Jesus, come on, Brian. I don't think it's this film in particular's job to do anything but leave the breadcrumbs. The breadcrumbs are there,
but we don't even know if they're leaving the breadcrumbs on purpose. Like that's my concern. Is that
I think they are.
At this point, they can kind of just pull shit up whenever they want. For instance,
I think they are.
I think that's a fair critique at the same. Bill, I would agree that like getting into nitpicks is unhealthy, but like I think that there is a fair question of whether some of the absences of lore or narrative or some of the choices in here are intentional or not.
Well, but like, I mean, the same thing could be said about kind of the finale of the first Guardians and why Peter was able to hold on to an Infinity Stone while it was, going haywire.
But they made
they answered that in this film. So if they answer your question in the next film, the criticism kind of starts to fade away, right?
I would say that in the first film, they very purposefully brought up his parentage and the fact that he held that Infinity Stone so that at the end of that movie, you had no doubt that the next film or would either answer it or continue to follow it. The end of this film, I don't feel like they left that same strong magnetic pull for the next film to gear towards. Does that make sense?
Why do you say that in the sense that it,
I guess because this film ended with like a 20-minute fireworks display for the dead blue guy.
Oh no.
So, but that's the thing is like it in the last movie, there was the finale, which was him holding the Infinity Cube and living. And they were like, whoa, how did a mortal do that? And it's like, well, his father, blah, blah, blah. But in the end of this film, it's just like, I had a cool dad. This was him. And we're all kind of happy now. But there was never a point where someone says to him, like, you were
really
God,
need
and now
someone
you're...
doesn't play the Marvel game, which is what I like so much about it.
I don't need them to literally tell me on the sequel. Like,
I'm just bringing up what you brought up, which is in the first film, they obviously had these breadcrumbs. But this time, I don't know if they're breadcrumbs or if they're just eating sloppily.
He's not talking about breadcrumbs as like you want to see the next film, though. He's talking about breadcrumbs in the sense that there is internal logic, whether or not you agree with that internal logic.
But I don't know that there is internal logic, is the entire point of what I'm saying.
No, I understand that, but you're specifically using that to then critique the ending of this film and saying that there's not the same pull that you felt in that first film.
Because you all brought up the ending of the first film with relation to his dad.
Okay.
I only brought up the ending of the first film and the obvious questions about the dad because you brought up that the first film kind of like made mention of his dad and then this film paid it off. But that was obviously a thing that the first film was priming you for in this film. And I don't know that any of my questions were necessarily meant to be primed for the next film. So whereas the first film thing to work towards, this film does not do that. But and I don't need it to, but you can't then use that as a defense for this film.
But if it answers it in the next film or in the next Avengers film, right, Infinity War, is that point now moot?
I think that it's correcting a mistake rather than paying off a story.
see, but your intimation there is that they don't have a plan.
Yeah,
that's your intimation.
Much. Yeah.
Okay, but you don't know that.
I don't know that. And the film does nothing to prove it either way.
Okay.
Cool. And that's, again, I could be wrong. They could already have the next three of these written out, but I don't think that if that was the case, that they did anything meaningful or earnest to set that up this time. And so whatever comes out in the third volume, or, you know, like Zune track number three, will feel as organic as the question of his dad being answered in this film did.
Sure. Okay. Fair.
Well, I definitely think that, you know, as we, again, this is entirely speculation, but I guess as we do think about this, I guess the timeline is the next Marvel movie will be Infinity War. Is that correct?
Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so what we're doing is we're spending more time in space because Thor Ragnarok is going to take place in space. And so that's going to start folding in
space
a lot more of the it's going to start folding in a lot more of these kind of celestial characters, I believe. Maybe some Titans, maybe some Celestials, things like that. And so all of a sudden our scope is just going to keep expanding until Infinity War. So
I mentioned that specifically because it does seem like since we've answered that question of parentage and, you know, we are at a place where these characters have some contentment about their place, you know, as outsiders. And therefore, we're then gearing up for very much the next arc, which will specifically involve them in an Avengers movie, at least as I they're part of the Avengers, right?
I think they're going to be in one of those two movies, yes.
It'll be interesting to
see, because we've just brought up how close we are to that Infinity War thing, it will be interesting to see how they do that. Because in this film, they didn't... You know, in the first film, they had the Infinity Stone, which was enough of a connection. This one doesn't have that, really. Like, again, the only connection is Thanos, but he's been only glimpsed so far, and so he doesn't feel like a connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious as to, like, how much these Infinity War movies are going to have to do to get all these people in the same place. Like, is it going to be the type of thing where, like, the first movie is them failing, and then the post-credit sequence is the Guardians of the Galaxy showing up and being like, "What's up, bitches?"
It might kind of be that, but I mean definitely because there are two parts to the Avengers Infinity War kind of
there
saga.
Are? What?
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't know that.
Wow,
Michael, Mike, how can you pay attention to this much cinema news and not know that?
We're hurting Mike on this episode between the reveal that there's a guy named Apocalypse and all the other, and now this. I feel like we just need to end it so he can go lay down.
I just said I liked this one, and then you do this to me? Are you kidding me?
Hey, Thor Ragnarok looks fun.
Yeah, it does. I don't think it's entirely
just the song choice in the trailer.
I do want to mention a couple of things. The first thing is it kind of needs to be mentioned that Star-Lord's parentage, at least in the comics, was definitely not Ego. So this is all kind of brand new stuff, and they keep doing this. And I think I will give Marvel and Kevin Feige a lot of credit for, like, these are obviously well-known characters in a lot of senses. Maybe not so much the Guardians, but a lot of these characters have several decades of comic book histories behind them and stuff like that. And they still find and manage to kind of tweak and mold things like what they did with Civil War, where they killed Tony's father. And, you know, apparently Bucky did that. And that,
and
to my knowledge,
the entire, like, point of the Civil War in the comics was completely different from the Civil War as we know it in the cinematic universe.
Yeah. And so they keep doing this where they're like, cool, I'm glad y'all have all that history and knowledge. We don't give a shit about that. Like, we're going to have fun, and we're going to make something that just kind of makes sense inside of our own galaxy. And that way,
yeah, they're treating the movies like, you know, they have the like, what are they? They have, like, the Infinite or the Extreme or...
You're talking about, like, the Ultimate Universe. Yeah, where they're a little bit slightly different. Yeah.
That's what they treat the movies like, which I think is an intelligent way to do it, because why the hell not? We should probably wrap up. We're almost pushing an hour and a half.
I guess the one other thing I wanted to say in relation to this is... Bill, you probably have the most context on this, but... So there are 5 post-credit sequences, which I was so angry about when I first heard about it. But honestly, they're not that bad in actual practice. But
they don't actually happen after the credits, which is delightful. It's like
throughout.
Yeah.
I actually
like the idea that they want you to stay through the credits. Which is kind of one of those things where a lot of people – there's a lot of strong opinions about, like, staying through the credits regardless of if there's anything actually after the film, right? A lot of people are just like, you got to pay your respects, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just like, yeah, but I don't need to pay my respects to the 2000 –
I'll just,
like,
scroll
CGI
through IMDb really quickly.
Like I'm just like, cool. Like, there's 2,000 CGI workers on each of these movies by now. Yeah. Like, I'm over it. The credits are absurd.
Sorry. Okay. Well, what I actually wanted to say, though, is related to specifically, you know, our curiosities about where this is specifically going to go. It seems like only one of those 5 credit sequence. Fine. 2 of those credit sequences seem related to the future. Something which is Adam, which I have... give no shits about, and I have no idea what it means. And then Sylvester Stallone, which we didn't even fucking talk about.
Oh yeah,
but
that was
some kind of other form, other group of Ravagers. Like, I did find that so strange. I guess what I'm getting at is that this is so strange in the sense that it very much feels like a Marvel movie in that it is going through the motions, and I don't mean that pejoratively in terms of the formula, but also that it is very small scale, but then it does also have these weird reminders that world is always coming back around.
Do you think that Teen Groot is not something that has to do with the future? Doesn't that count?
I guess it does. although honestly, sorry to generalize all teenagers, but all teenagers are shitty, so why would I want to watch a movie about a anthropomorphized teenager?
This is a good point.
Because I am Groot.
I love that slowly but surely everyone is learning to understand.
I don't
language.
Want like porn jokes with Groot. Like, no thank you.
Yeah, that was...
What would he even look at? Flowers?
Oof, Bill. I mean... You see one of those slow motion videos of a bee landing on a flower.
Okay. Michael,
commercials.
You were asking about Adam. Do you want to know a little bit about that?
You can make me vaguely interested.
You have literally 30 seconds.
That's in relation to Adam Warlock, which is a premier, like, big bad Yeah, he's basically going to be the one that ultimately ends up taking on Thanos.
Did you think that introduction was good?
Wait, hold on. I have a question. He's going to take on Thanos, but he's a big bad himself, so it's going to be like bad on bad?
Yeah, because it's like this with like all of these guys. Like Adam Warlock, I think, bounces from good to bad depending on who he's got to fight.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, you know, considering that he, I guess, now is going to be coming from the what are they called?
Sovereign.
We've messed their name up so many times this podcast.
Every time that I've set out to say Sovereign, I've said Sovereign. I almost called them Celestials. It's not my fault that those two things introduced in this movie are so close.
Yes.
All right.
I don't blame you.
Myself. Okay, so he's a guy who's going to show up, and he's apparently yellow.
But I just wanted what I was trying to say in general, though, is that is especially the thing, oddly, that felt so perfunctory to me, is those things that reminded me that I'm still in this universe. I almost do wish that this kept its self-enclosed, vacuum-sealed quality. You know, but then again, I guess people would have even more ammunition for this feeling so slight. Like, I can see, I don't agree with your characterization of, you know, the entire movie happening in the third act, Brian, but I definitely do see that some people who want that more grandiose narrative would find this unsatisfying.
Yeah, I mean, I just found it unsatisfying because for like 2 hours I kept asking, what are we doing here? Like, what are we building towards? And then when we built to it, it felt rushed and super unsatisfying, and the final battle was a CGI mess that was both perfunctory and built on nothing but a raft of like just what's the word I'm looking for? It's not perfunctory, it's like there was no thought in most of it, and capricious might be a word. You know, like, we have to get to the surface. How are we going to do it? Oh, well, luckily, columns of Earth are just happening to move up, so let's jump on one of those. And it's like, we got to wait for Peter. It's like, all right, well, I only have one jetpack and one spacesuit because that's what the plot demands. It's not like he had enough for everyone and you saw him losing them as time went on, or like he had to give them to other people. You know, it's, you know, it was just stuff like that. It was just like nothing was set up. It just all felt like this is what we've got to do to end this thing. And that's what they did. Mm. You know, and maybe that's fine with some people, but it was kind of annoying that, you know, there was so much ostensible setup to this thing that none of it really paid off. You know, like they have a 400-minute long thing where Star-Lord is just asking people for tape, and they don't you know, they don't even have a point where the raccoon says like, and I have an extra thingamabob and a whatsamacallit in my pocket, but I don't have any tape. You know, it's just,
I found
like,
that really
point,
entertaining.
Whatever. Oh, well. This is over.
Yep, I enjoyed that entire sequence.
Whatever. Let's move on.
Brian's like, you can go to fucking hell.
The thing is, I could see a world in which I enjoyed that sequence, but like not coming as it does after all of the other nonsense I've had to sit through. You know, I just like, yeah. I couldn't. By that point, I was so exhausted that I just couldn't deal with it anymore. Anyway, thank you for listening to us prattle on about this nonsense for an hour and a half. It's a pleasure as always. Next weekend, we'll be talking about, I believe, King Arthur?
Kill me.
Legend of the Sword?
You don't have a quiet passion around you? Is that what you were saying earlier?
Yeah. We may try to find something else to do, but our
maybe a VOD or something.
Yeah, I guess we could do that. Well, all right, so again, our default is King Arthur unless we can find something else to do.
You're not dying to watch Snatched?
We could do Boo, a Madea Halloween. Finally,
we could.
Oh, we could.
Well,
the second one's coming out this year. So,
oh my God. Well, we will have to talk about this more. In the meanwhile, In the meantime, let's get out of here. I am exhausted. I spent all weekend building a deck, and I am super tired. And I want this to be over. So we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema that has a lot of movies that are a hell of a lot better than Guardians 2. I should have mentioned previously that they have a Mike Nichols double bill coming up. So they have Carnal Knowledge, and they also have The Graduate streaming now. So hop on the Mubi train and see some Mike Nichols films. Mike Nichols, who passed away last year?
Yeah.
So this is a great way to honor him. The Graduate is now celebrating its 50th anniversary, so that's pretty cool. And you can see those on Mubi with your free trial. Go to Mubi, MUBI.com/filmstage, and you have a free 30-day trial on us. Mubi, New Year, no tagline. I should probably stop saying New Year. We're 5 months into this sumbitch. Anyway, that's it. That's all. Let's tell the fine people at home where they can find us between now and the next time when we will be talking about something. Bill Graham.
I guess you can find me looking up Sylvester Stallone's name in this film, which is Stakar O'Gord. Jesus Christ.
Stakar O'God.
Yeah. Anyways, I can be found on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing for movies on the film stage and freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I will be crying at the realization that Infinity War is, in fact, not one, but two movies. And you can also, if there are any Chicago listeners, I will definitely be at a few screenings of the Chicago Critics Film Festival. There's a lot of great films there. Things that it starts on Thursday or Friday. Things like Ghost Story, The Big Sick, other things that I'm totally failing to remember. But say hello if you're there.
The Maryland Film Festival is going on, or was going on, and Golden Exits, the new film by Alex Ross Perry, was playing there, and
Brian is first in line.
And I did not go.
Guys, Michelle Yeoh is in this movie.
Really?
Yeah.
She is Alita Ogord's Stakar's female counterpart.
Mother. Yeah, she's in that post-credit sequence.
Oh, fuck. All right. Anyway, we're done. We're fucking done here. You can find me on Twitter. I haven't been live tweeting my reread of The Ton, the Legend of Cthulhu, because I am rereading it, but oh my god, it's even more crazy than I remembered. So expect some clips of that when I get through it and I've marked the best parts. Here's just a taste. There's a point where a 7-year-old who wants to go kill a bunch of people says to his charioteer, "We did not come here to run from danger." So that's the kind of shit you're dealing with. You can also find me writing on thefilmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net. And yeah, that's it. Twitter, Brian J. Rowan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for sticking with us. I know it's been a chore. And tune in next time. Like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you. Didn't you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, "What I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later, can I have them, please?" And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't